afternoon and welcome to Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody is traveling this week. She may be with us at some point checking in during the program. But in any event, for all your gold and silver needs, call her toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Today's Tuesday, April 12, 2022. Happy National Grilled Cheese Day, everybody. You know what I had for lunch today? Well, it's also National Only Child Day, a day that celebrates the individual child, the one without any sibling, or siblings, the one and onlys. You know who you are. There are more of you these days than in decades before, too. According to Pew Research, the number of families with only one child has doubled since 1970. Statistics show that as of 2014, about a quarter of women who had given birth gave birth to only one child. And the number continues to gradually trend upward. So, for all you listeners who grew up an only child with no Christmas presents, birthday gifts, or tasty snacks to have to share with a brother or sister, we salute you. Now, let's get started with the market report brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Good day in the precious metal, well, in the gold and silver market, I should say. Gold as high as about 1980 earlier today. Did adjust downward some, but still in the New York after spot markets up $13 and change at about 1968 an ounce. Silver up over 1%, 31 cents at 25.49. Platinum down 1.25% at 9.75. Palladium down almost 5% at 23.92. Now, oil, WTI, West Texas Intermediate Domestic Crude, up big today, 6.6%, back over $100 a barrel at 100.54. The dollar index also up over 100 at 100.32. And that means bond market... not so good of a day, actually, here in the States. Abroad, it was relatively flat, little to the upside. But the benchmark 10-year yield down to 2.72. 5-year, 2.68, roughly. The 2-year, 2.38. No longer inverted, but close to it, for sure. Then in the equities, it's been a roughly up and down day. Closing right now. Let's do this one more time, see what we come up with. We have the Dow down 87 and change to close at 34,220. The broader S&P 500 down 15 points, 43.97. And the tech-laden NASDAQ down 40 points to close at 13,371 and change. And that about does it for today's market report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. A lot of news out there today, financial, geopolitical, and otherwise. It's CPI day. Yes, it is. And we're learning this morning that prices consumers pay for everyday items surged in March to their highest levels since the early days of the Reagan administration. Bureau of Labor Statistics reported this morning that the Consumer Price Index jumped 8.5% from a year ago, about the same as the 8.4 expectation. Excluding the volatile food and energy numbers, the so-called core CPI increased 6.5%. The data reflect prices not seen in the U.S. since the stagflation days of the late 70s and early 80s. Now, March's headline reading was, in fact, the highest since December 1981. The core inflation, however, appears to be leveling off some, rising just 0.3% for the month, less than the 0.5% estimate. Now, despite the increases, markets reacted positively, initially anyway, to the report. Stock market indexes rose at the opening bell and government bond yields declined, which means the par value of those treasuries increased. Economist Andrew Hunter at Capital Economics thinks the March increase will mark the peak for inflation as year-over-year comparisons drive the numbers lower and energy prices begin to subside. Well, we will see. Still, due to the March surge in inflation, real earnings, despite rising 5.6% from a year ago, aren't keeping pace with the cost of living. Inflation adjusted to average hourly earnings posted a seasonally adjusted 0.8% decline for the month, as according to a separate BLS report. The inability of wages to keep up with costs indeed could add inflationary pressures in the coming months. The Atlanta Fed wage tracker for March indicates gains of another 6%. Which is symptomatic of inflationary pressures continuing to broaden. Economist Brian Colton at Fitch Ratings points out that the core inflation deceleration was due largely to a drop in auto prices, which I write about in this week's American Survival newsletter, which we'll talk a little bit more about in the third segment. Other prices continued to show increases. Shelter costs, which make up about a third of the CPI weighting, increased another 0.5% on the month, making the 12-month gain a fairly blistering 5%, the highest since May 1991. Now, to try to rein in inflation, as we know, the Fed's expected to continue raising interest rates at their May meeting, probably by a half a percentage point. Through the remainder of the year and into 2023. Where it stops, nobody knows. But the last time prices were this high, the Fed raised its benchmark rate to nearly 20%. Pulling the economy into a recession that finally defeated inflation, but also left Americans licking their wounds for an extended period of time. What's past is prologue? Again, we shall see. Ian Shepherdson, who's chief economist of Pantheon Macroeconomics, observed, overall, this report is encouraging at the margin. Much depends on the path of used vehicle prices, which is very hard to forecast with confidence. Now, the price increases came from many of the usual culprits. Food rising 1% for the month, almost 9% over the year. Energy prices up 11% in the month, 32% annually, as gasoline prices popped 18.3% in March, of course boosted by the Russian invasion and the pressure it's been exerting on supplies around the world. Now, in a sign of economic rebound from a sector hard hit during the pandemic, airline fares jumped by almost 11%. Last month, and we're up 24% from a year ago. In a related story, Food prices around the world soared to record highs last month as the war in Ukraine exacerbated what was already a global crisis. In March, the food price index published by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization surged to its highest level since the index's inception in 1990. In poorer countries where folks spend upward of 50% or more of their income on food, these numbers are surely devastating. The tools that central banks are using to fight inflation, the rate hikes that I mentioned, plus quantitative tightening, are meant to curtail demand, but can do, or at least are doing, little to address global food supply problems. Gene Boivin, who heads the BlackRock Investment Institute, says that raising rates will not resolve the war or address the supply chain. The prices of wheat, sunflower oil in particular, are rising because of the war. Some Ukrainian ports are outrightly closed. Others face disruptions or near destruction. Issues will certainly drag into next year as some farmers in Ukraine, which is the leading sunflower oil exporter and top five wheat supplier, are simply unable to plant crops amid falling bombs and bullets flying overhead. Now, speaking of the war, UK intelligence is suggesting that Russian forces are preparing for what's expected to be a large and more focused push on expanding control in the east of Ukraine. Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky has also warned that Russia's deployed tens of thousands of troops to prepare new attacks in, in the eastern region that borders Russia. Meanwhile, the UK's foreign secretary said late last night that her government was working urgently to verify details of an alleged chemical weapons attack in the besieged city of Mariupol. And the U.S. Defense Department Press Secretary John Kirby also said the Pentagon was closely monitoring those reports. Now, it's initial reports that I've seen today suggest phosphorus was used. Now, that's not the kind of chemical or biological weapon that is usually thought of, but apparently it's a very, very nasty, stinging weapon. In any event, Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin are hosting their Indian counterparts in Washington this week and making the case that India should phase out its strategic relationship with Russia and let the U.S. be its primary defense and energy partner. Maintaining its supply of Russian oil and military equipment's the primary driver behind New Delhi's decision not to publicly blame Russia at this point for the invasion of Ukraine. But rather than chastise India, Austin and Blinken highlighted that the world's largest democracy has condemned the invasion in broad terms and noted that New Delhi has been sending medicines to Ukraine. They also said the U.S. and India will increase their defense collaboration in space and cyberspace, even as India takes delivery on a set of Russian S-400 missiles it purchased a couple of years ago. Despite that, Blinken said Washington is willing and able to be a security partner of choice for India. Now, shortly after Russia invaded Ukraine in February, India purchased millions of barrels of Russian oil at a discount while European buyers imposed sanctions and began to cut ties. But here, too, India has met little resistance from Washington. Blinken said every country is differently situated and has different needs and requirements. We're looking to allies and partners not to increase their reliance on and purchases of Russian energy. Probably a tall order for the world's largest democracy. Now, Data from the Central Bank of Russia show that Russia's cash flows soared during the first quarter, despite the broad economic sanctions imposed by the West, as Russia benefited from soaring energy prices brought on by its invasion. Russia's surprisingly healthy finances, relatively speaking, shows its continued sales of oil and gas remain a formidable economic tool for Vladimir Putin. During the first quarter, the Russian Federation posted a record surplus in its current account. That's a broad measure of its trade with other countries of the world, as surging energy prices translated into a gusher of export revenues. Surplus for the first 3 months of the year rose to $58.2 billion, way up from the $22.5 billion during the first quarter last year. The Institute of International Finance projects that Russia will post a record $250 billion surplus this year. And certainly a surplus of that size could essentially make up for the entirety of the Russian central bank reserves that Western countries froze through sanctions. Russia remains effectively severed from much of the world economy by those sanctions. Still, its big account surplus means it can still get the money it needs to finance the war, plus pay its government employees, even stabilize its fiat currency by intervening in foreign exchange markets. Russia's ruble, which we told you plunged by almost 75% after fresh Western sanctions were imposed in late February, has now more than fully recovered. And that's a sign that Russia's finding ways to adjust to its new status as an economic pariah. But a large current account surplus doesn't mean that the Russian economy or its population is thriving. The surplus, which is exports minus imports, in part reflects the fact that imports into the country have fallen sharply. That's because of moves by Western companies to pull out of the country and the ruble's weakness over much of the first quarter. Combined, that's left Russian consumers simply unable to buy foreign goods, resulting in a worsening standard of living. Investors also fled the country as net capital outflows soared by 270%. Well, we're going to have to flee this program for a few minutes. We're heading into our first break. Please stick around. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Melody taking care of some personal business today. And leave her a message at 1-800-375-4188. Or call us on the web at dgscoins.com. DGScoins.com. While you're there, sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs. Just look for that dandy old mailbox. Now, boy, let's move to another part of the world, China. The Chinese stocks suffered their worst tumble in weeks yesterday amid growing pandemic lockdowns throughout the country. Lockdowns in China, manufacturing behemoth, could weaken both its economy and as well as the world's, and add fresh snafus to global supply chains, as we see and read about growing backups in some of the major ports there. China imposed a hard lockdown in Shanghai. It's a city of 25 million people and a major economic hub almost a month ago. Now, some fear that the lockdowns could also spread to the manufacturing center of Guangzhou. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index sank 3% yesterday, and the Shanghai Composite fell 2.6, though both recovered some of those losses today. Yesterday also brought fresh Chinese inflation stats, including their producer price index for March. That index, which measures wholesale prices charged by Chinese factories, showed a higher than expected annual increase of 8.3%. Chinese stocks had been rallying in recent weeks despite a worsening COVID picture, as investors appeared to be betting that the government would be forced to print and spend money to shore up an economy that was locking down. Not so much so. Higher than expected inflation could make Chinese policymakers leery of delivering the kind of help that they were able to offer in the early days of the virus. That is, more government spending and monetary easing. At the same time, many of Shanghai's millions of residents are facing food shortages because of the lockdowns. Scenes of residents rationing vegetables and begging local officials to allow them to search for food has cast a shadow on the Chinese government's pandemic response. Shanghai reported more than 26,000 new infections on Sunday, as the number of new daily infections continued to rise despite the city's lockdown. Today, some restrictions were eased for some of the city's residents. Shanghai residents are said to be scrambling for food as empty grocery shelves, unreliable government provisions, and strained food delivery services are making it hard to secure enough to eat. Extreme lockdown conditions and Communist Party censorship means journalists can't easily report on those things from the ground. So many Shanghai residents have actually turned to social media for support, posting photos of their few remaining vegetables and videos of residents demanding that local health authorities allow them to leave their building to look for food. Wow. In the Middle East, Pakistan has a new prime minister. That could augur well for the South Asian country's return to a healthier economy and its relationships with traditional supporters like the U.S. as well as its rival, neighbor India. Yesterday, Pakistan's parliament picked Shehbaz Sharif as the country's new PM, just days after his predecessor, Imran Khan, was ousted in a no-confidence vote in what one observer called the affirmation of democracy. The move was by no means inevitable in a country where no prime minister has served a full term in office. Surprising observers, the all-powerful Pakistani army, which has ruled the country for decades by staging coups, stayed in the background. A decisive intervention by the judiciary was the next surprise. Pakistan's Supreme Court ruled that the government of Imran Khan had to face a no-confidence vote that it had tried hard to block. Khan eventually lost the rescheduled trust vote in the early hours of Sunday and was removed from office. In his first speech as PM, the 70-year-old Sharif said he intended to refashion Pakistan as a paradise for investments while also announcing an increase in the minimum wage. Sharif's path ahead, though, is not easy. He's inherited an economy rattled by a current account deficit, as well as soaring inflation. One expert said he'll need to increase the state's capacity to accrue revenue through taxation and increase in investment, especially in the export sector. Easier said than done. Jane Schwemline of the Albright Stone Ridge Group said the dream for Pakistan is to be able to export to China. Reality for Pakistan is that they export to the U.S. and Europe. Pakistan's on its 23rd bailout from the International Monetary Fund. 23rd. The country's economy is under pressure from rising inflation at over 10% right now amid the spiraling prices of crude oil and other commodities blamed on the war in Ukraine. Observers say that India in particular will be paying attention to the new administration. The key priority for the new government, however, will be to fix ties with Washington. Now, Khan had used his oft-repeated allegation of a U.S. plot to oust him from power to block the no-confidence vote against his government. That conspiracy theory, however, went by the wayside. He claimed the U.S. was upset by a perception that Pakistan under him had moved closer to Russia and China. Hiss, hiss. Global trade posts a massive rebound, nearly 10% last year from a 5% decline in 2020, providing a surprising tailwind for world economies through most of the pandemic. Thanks to Russia's war in Ukraine, this year looks more like a return to pre-COVID trends of around 3% growth worldwide. Now, that's not GDP growth. That's growth in global trade. Now, that's among the takeaways from a revised outlook released today from the WTO. The Geneva-based trade body lowered its projection for growth in global merchandise trade, down from its previous projection of 4.7%. The organization also said it expects global trade growth of 3.4% next year. They cited two main reasons why. Despite their small shares in world trade and output, Russia and Ukraine are key suppliers of essential goods like food, energy, and fertilizers, supplies of which are now threatened. Plus, lockdowns in China are again disrupting seaborne trade at a time when supply chain pressures appear to be easing somewhat. That, of course, could lead to renewed shortages of manufacturing inputs and higher inflation because of the continuing, strong demand. There's wider potential damage that the WTO expressed concern about. Geopolitical strains that threaten to undo global economies tied together by commerce. WTO Director General Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala said, History teaches us that dividing the world economy into rival blocks and turning our backs on the poorest countries leads neither to prosperity nor to peace. The WTO, he continued, can play a pivotal role by providing a forum where countries can discuss their differences without resorting to force, and it deserves to be supported in that mission. Here's an interesting story. A Christian Chinese national who spent 10 months in a Xinjiang detention camp has arrived in the U.S. After months of behind-the-scenes lobbying by lawmakers, human rights activists, and international lawyers, the man, I'm not sure if I'm getting this pronunciation right, Obelbek Turdakan, will provide evidence that international human rights lawyers say is vital to the case they presented to the International Criminal Court, arguing that China has committed crimes against humanity in Xinjiang. Obelbek and his wife and child were authorized to enter the U.S. on what's called a significant benefit parole. That permits entry for special purposes like testifying in a proceeding because the expected value of the evidence, but falls short of actually granting any kind of immigration status. Obelbek navigated multiple Asian border crossings and months in diplomatic limbo shortly after he and his family landed at Dulles on Friday. Obelbeck's a unique witness to Chinese government repression in Xinjiang, according to international lawyers. He's known as an ethnic Kyrgyz. Uyghurs are the most populous ethnic group targeted for detention there, but several other groups who live in Xinjiang, including the Kazakhs, the Kyrgyz, Tajiks, and Hui, have also faced detention and other forms of repression. Obelbek's the first Christian detained in the camps to come forward publicly about his experience. The Chinese government has claimed the camps in Xinjiang are merely intended to de-radicalize Islamic extremists. But people without religious affiliation and a small number of Christians are known to have been detained as well. Obelbek also studied law. While in the detention camp, he says he carefully observed actions by Chinese authorities with an eye to what could be potentially violations of international law. Well, that'll be something to follow, a major development indeed. Now, you might remember the big shipping container boat stuck in the Suez Canal months ago. It took several days to turn itself around and find its way out. Well, the subject during the Board of Public Works meeting Wednesday in Maryland was wetlands licenses. State Comptroller Peter Franchot, it might be Franchot, brought up the thing that everyone was actually thinking about, the boat. Ever Forward, it's the name of the enormous container ship stuck in the Chesapeake Bay that's been nearly a one-month headache for the U.S. Coast Guard, the Port of Baltimore, and Maryland's Department of the Environment, has become a concern for the governor, Comptroller, and the state treasurer. Franchot says each day that goes by increases the potential for a hull breach and disruptions to the critical port of Baltimore. The hull breach, of course, could result in ecological, reputational, and economic risks to Maryland. The ship has been the subject of both local curiosity and nationwide conversation now. Owned by Taiwan-based shipping company Evergreen Marine Corp, the vessel departed Baltimore on March 13th and steered outside the Craig Hill Channel becoming lodged on the bottom just off the shores of Pasadena. By the time it's freed, it will have been more than a month since it originally became wedged. At almost 1,100 feet long and nearly 158 feet wide, it's the largest boat ever stuck in the Chesapeake Bay. Doug Myers, who the Maryland senior scientist for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, drove the enormity of the situation home during an interview where he said, "This is a very large ship and it's stuck. The ship's 42 feet deep and it's in 24 feet of water. That means 18 feet or more of it is buried in mud." Oh, Lord. Rescue efforts are being coordinated by the Coast Guard with support from state agencies. Plans to free the ship were put in place right after it ran aground. Initial efforts centered around dredging, clearing away the mud from around its hull, and then using towboats to pull the ship out. Those first attempts failed miserably, supposedly. Dredging continued to a depth of 43 feet, along with an additional tow. That didn't work either, and dredging was finally halted a week ago. Now, the mud and sand dredged from around the boat was taken to a nearby island off of the coast of Maryland's eastern shore in Talbot County. With all attempts to free the vessel so far unsuccessful, well, Coast Guard officials have decided the next course of action is to remove cargo containers from the boat, hoping that will lighten it enough and return them to the Seagirt Marine Terminal in the port of Baltimore. Now, weather permitting, this latest effort's expecting to run at least until April 15th. Phew, what a mess. Now, briefly here in the last seconds of this segment, President Biden's in Corn Rich, Iowa today to announce that he's suspending a federal rule and allow the sale of higher ethanol gasoline this summer. Again, trying to lower prices at the pump that have spiked. Most gasoline sold in the U.S. is blended with 10% ethanol, and the EPA is going to issue an emergency waiver to allow the sale of 15% ethanol blends that's usually prohibited in the summer months because of concerns that it adds to smog in high temperatures. Hey, there's some good music. It means we're heading into another break. Again, please stick around. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. Dave Allen with you. Melody taking care of some personal business today. We're at 1-800-375-4188. Now, our latest American Survival newsletter has hit the streets. Again, you can sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs at dgscoins.com. I have an article called Inflation on the Rise and Getting Higher. The new government inflation number is out today. And as I talked about in the first segment, it's a doozy. For one thing, the CPI for March reflects the surge in energy prices because of the war in Ukraine. And that's pushed the government's headline number to yet another multi-decade high. The big question, if not the biggest facing the economy now, is will inflation come down on its own? Or will it require the Fed to bring on a recession? March numbers provide fresh evidence of the reality we're living in. And today's inflation report is less instructive on whether forces that initially drove up prices, like the supply disruptions driving up prices of goods, are starting to fade, but that price pressures are now driving service costs up. Many economists were expecting today's release to show 8.4% inflation over the last year. And at 8.5, it's the highest rate since December 1981, after growing at an annual rate of 7.9% for the 12 months ending in February. And the path forward certainly depends on underlying inflation trends like wages and the ability of businesses to raise prices as opposed to geopolitical events. For durable goods, relief should come if and when global supply crunches ease. In one positive sign, used car prices declined in March, leading some to wonder if high used car prices are no longer going to be a fact of life. As Melody and I have been discussing here for months, an unprecedented surge in used vehicle prices was an early driver of pandemic-era inflation. The Manheim Used Vehicle Value Index, that's a gauge of wholesale market prices for used vehicles, dropped for the second straight month. Wholesale prices for used vehicles are now 5.4% lower than their January peak of $21,754. Typically, Manheim prices, which reflect sales to auto dealers, are a leading indicator of the prices consumers see at the lot a couple of months later. Well, another month, two or three, and we'll see if, in fact, this lower pricing has become a trend. Now, another big question is whether the recent drop proves short-lived, given the fresh supply chain snafus caused by Putin's invasion and China's latest lockdowns. And then, of course, there's oil. Felix Salmons of Axios argues that the U.S. could make more than $5 billion by waiting a few years to replenish its oil reserves. President Biden has committed to sell 1 million barrels of oil per day from the nation's Strategic Petroleum Reserve over the next 6 months. All of that oil will need to be replaced at some point, and ideally at a profit. Why not? Salmons calculates that if the U.S. were to sell a total of 180 million barrels at the current price of $98 a barrel, give or take, that would produce total proceeds of about $18 billion. Contrast that to delivery of oil in the future, which is worth a lot less. For example, a barrel of oil a year from now is worth less than $90. In 2 years, it's about $80. Traders would be happy to enter into a contract to deliver oil in 2029 at less than $67 a barrel. And oil sold from the SPR needs to be replenished somehow and sometime. But according to government rules, if the Department of Energy believes there's a high probability that the cost can be reduced without diminishing national security goals, well, it's allowed to contract for the delivery of oil at a future date. In other words, the government can sell oil at $98 now, enter into a contract to buy it back at $67 in a few years' time, thus guaranteeing itself a profit of what, $31 a barrel. If it did that for all 180 million barrels, which it most likely won't, the profit would come to $5.6 billion. I mean, $31 profit times 180 million barrels. The DOE didn't want to wait that long to replenish its reserves, even refilling at the March 2023 price of $89 per barrel would get it a profit of $1.6 billion. So, the more the oil the U.S. sells at current inflated prices, the more profit it can make by buying back the oil at lower prices in the future. Actually, a good way to get back some of the windfall profits recently earned by oil companies at our expense. Still, services, excluding energy products, account for 57% of the CPI versus only 13% for durable goods. So it wouldn't take much for the services sector to take over goods as a key driver, preventing overall inflation from coming down. For example, look at rent increases, which have accelerated in the last 3 months, rising 0.6% in February. That reflects tight housing supply and rising incomes. And as long as rent costs keep rising, it'll keep inflation from easing as much as it otherwise would. Prices are also rising for services like health insurance and hotel stays. The fading of the pandemic may mean that consumers shift more of their spending towards services and push up prices amid a finite supply. Companies that sell those services want to make up for rising wage costs and enjoy the pricing power that comes with robust demand. In short, higher inflation will headlines today's morning news. And as bad as the government numbers will look, remember that in actuality, it's undoubtedly worse. John Williams of ShadowStats.com says the CPI is actually already between 12 and 16%. Applying the older and in many cases more credible methodologies the government used in the 1980s and 90s. Whatever the numbers actually are, however, the more important question to look at right now is whether inflation in the services sector has picked up momentum just as durable goods inflation starts to fade. Either way, ladies and gentlemen, make sure you protect your savings with plenty of physical gold and silver. Now, next, a few life lessons. Sally Jenkins, one of my favorite sports columnists, has brilliantly captured the secret to success in business and life. She writes that Tom Brady, the greatest NFL quarterback ever, proved that any kid with perfectly ordinary athletic prospects, the middle of the pack or who doesn't come with some preloaded anatomical gift, can construct greatness. And Axios co-founder Jim Vanderhei says this is true in every dimension of life. You don't need to be born a genius or sports sensation, attend Harvard, or have friends in high places to be the very best at what you do. He says it actually motivated him and helped him appreciate a few lessons on how the so-called middle of the packers can beat the dealer. First, you do something you would do for free. You can't fake passion, and passion leads to a healthy daily obsession. If you find a way to get paid to do what you love most, well, that comes naturally. Second, be smart enough to steal from those smarter than you. Be a student of those crushing what you want to crush, and copy their best habits or moves. Read, listen to podcasts, pick up the phone, call people you admire. You'll be shocked at how generous most people are in sharing their tricks. Third, surround yourself with goodness and greatness. And four, grit is it. There's no substitute for getting up every day and pouring uncommon time and effort into what matters most. This means sucking it up when you flop or fail and get up again. Amen. Now, today, as I reported on the program a few weeks ago, at the end of March, the Fed released the names of the Wall Street trading houses and the amounts they had borrowed under three of the Fed's emergency bailout programs. The quote, emergency repo loans, the Fed's primary dealer credit facility, and the Fed's money market mutual fund liquid facility, which I'll call the triple MLF. Fed also released the details on its commercial paper funding facility. But the first three I mentioned illustrated which units of the mega too-big-to-fail banks had become illiquid and needed Fed bailouts stretching over many months. As Wall Street on Parade had previously reported, the Fed's release of the repo loan transaction data was met with a complete news blackout by just about all media. That news blackout continued with the release of the quarterly data on March 31st, and it's extended to the PDCF and the triple MLF. Now, Bloomberg Law did publish a summary about the PDCF, but it was buried. Now, the reason for this news blackout may just have to do something with the mainstream media's godlike worship of the Fed and its love fest with Jamie Dimon, the chair and CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase. As it turns out, units of J.P. Morgan Chase were among the largest borrowers under the Fed's repo loans, the PDCF and its triple MLF, despite Dimon's perpetual bragging about his bank's fortress balance sheet. Amazing. And let's not forget, that bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, has racked up five felony charges under Dimon's so-called Lea stewardship, which should have been a screaming call to the Fed, which supervises Chase. Now, an analysis of the Fed's labyrinth transaction data for its triple MLF shows that 10 of J.P. Morgan's money market funds needed to tap liquidity from the Fed on its first day of operation in 2020. In fact, on the very first day of the triple MLF facility, J.P. Morgan's money market funds borrowed a staggering $9 billion, 32% of the $27 billion in funds loaned that day by that program. J.P. Morgan's money market funds liquidity problem appears to have centered on its tax-free money market funds holding billions of dollars in New York City's Metropolitan Transportation Authority short-term revenue notes. Those were prominent among the instruments submitted as collateral to the Fed for J.P. loans from the triple MLF. The MTA notes apparently could not be sold by J.P. Morgan to meet redemption requests without causing the money market fund to break the buck. Now, money market mutual funds are expected to trade at a constant or stable $1 per share. It's known as breaking the buck when money market funds rarely but occasionally trade for less than a dollar a share. And as Pam and Russ Martins remind us, this occurred at several money market funds during the financial crisis of 2008. And really exacerbated the panic occurring at the time. exactly why J.P. Morgan's money market funds held so much money in one municipal issues notes ought to warrant the attention of its regulators. Morgan was also an outside user at the Fed's PDCF. Showed the Fed had an outstanding balance there of $49.5 billion. The trading unit at J.P. Morgan had borrowed $14 billion, or 28% of that total. According to the quarterly data releases by the Fed for its repo loans, the trading unit of J.P. Morgan borrowed $2.6 trillion in term-adjusted cumulative repo loans in the fourth quarter of 2019, and another $3.6 trillion in the first quarter of 2020. Not only has there been a news blackout by mainstream media on these enormous loans, but from the Fed to the largest bank in the U.S., there's been zero lack of interest thus far by the Senate Banking and House Financial Services Committee. That's got to change. Concerned citizens, call your senators and reps in Congress and make that happen. Well, look, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back on Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Todd, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning in to Fitness. Please be safe out there. Bye-bye.
There seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.